wish you were soft and smooth.
The world in a minute.
Morning sanity stations carry no news of the world.
Corporate America owns all the networks.
Freedom of the press is only guaranteed when you own the press.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is identification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. ABC, Disney, NBC, GE, Murdoch is Foxy, and with a hint, he owns a pen. The camera, the sword, buy a Coke, buy a Ford, getting broke, getting bored.
And experience your psychic connection.
We don't have shit to say. We don't have anything to do.
Selling attitude like food for the masses. Junk consumption. We are lumping. Just a bumpkin to the corporate state. You can't satiate what you can't negotiate. Your will's been snatched. The bill's attached. Flim flam diagram. Data jam. Handicap caught it. Yo, you bought it. A mind is a profitable thing to waste. You want another taste, baby? Got news, goo. What we need to know.
We got news goo. I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector. The song by my buddy and musical partner, Polarity One. We've done a number of songs, musical takes on the issues of the day. And news goo is really about the need to challenge our media system. That's what I try to do as much as I can every day on my blog, on newsdissector.net, my books, which I'm going to be talking to you about in this special program. We're talking in a pre-recording of a program that will be aired very soon here on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com or PRN.FM. You'll be able to get it in the archives as well. The program is really an effort, an extension of the blog I write every day at NewsDissector.net, offering a counter-narrative to the news, offering dissections of what is in the news and what's, more importantly, what's missing from the news, what we don't hear about, what we don't see on television. You know, in my own career, I joined the media because I wanted to help, you know, deal with the problems of the world. And then I found out that the media is one of the problems of the world. And in fact, the media is one of the reasons why people are not as informed as they should be or could be about what's actually happening in America and in the world. So in my own background, though, I really haven't talked about this much on the air, and I hope I won't be boring you with it, but I wanted to, you know, have an opportunity for a little personal ventilation, a little opportunity for you to get to know me a little bit better, because mostly I have guests. We talk about issues and whatnot. I worked for many years in radio at WBCN in Boston back in the day, in the 70s. So I've been on the air for a long time. And the idea of the Progressive Radio Network that Gary Knowles started you know, appeal to me, because here's an effort using online networks to actually get information to people. And I was thrilled when he invited me to be a host, although I've been very busy with other things. Have been able to do that. Cat Waters has been helping and working with me and producing on the radio. So we're trying to offer a point of view, a perspective that you don't hear that often, not just hyping issues, but asking critical questions. My own background is I grew up here in New York City in the boogie down Bronx, you know, back in the day, back in the 50s. I went to DeWitt Clinton High School, a high school. I'm now making a film about one of the great schools in America that's being threatened with closure by the Bloomberg administration. It was a school that more than 100,000 people went to over the course of a century. So that was my origins here in New York in education. I then went to Cornell. I studied at the School of Industrial and Labor Relations, studying labor history. My dad worked as a garment cutter. He was in the unions, the labor the ILGWU, International Ladies Garment Workers Union, later united with the Amalgamated Clothing Workers Union into forming Unite. And that background in the labor movement in my own family really sensitized me to the values and the gaps in America where working people had to struggle so hard and ended up with so little. I grew up in the Bronx in a housing project that was built by the unions, by the Amalgamated Clothing Workers Union, called the Amalgamated, and it's still going. It's a co-op. And I think those values of cooperation, of people actually running a housing project, are very rare and really need. There needs to be more co-ops like it in America. And, of course, here in New York, there still is one called Penn South, south of Penn Station, near where I live today in Chelsea. So those are the values that I got involved with. And when I graduated from high school, I'd been the editor of the high school newspaper. Having that experience led me into a career of journalism, which I've remained in to this day. So, you know, again, early influences, people, great teachers, Lou Simon, our high school journalism teacher, inspired me to realize the importance and the power of communications. Many Clinton graduates went into the media in various important roles, movie industry and the like. Robert Klein, my friend, the comedian, he went to Clinton, as did many others. So this is a culture, if you will, of communications coming out of the neighborhoods of the Bronx, working class turned middle class turned back to working class and lower class, because the Bronx was sort of destroyed by landlords, buildings burned and the like, and people fled to other communities out of fear, because of drugs, because of street crime and the like. So, you know, there's a lot of poverty in neighborhoods that were once, you know, kind of epicenters of middle class development and, you know, where people could find the American dream. Today, the American dream is lost to so many, and so many kids are growing up without, you know, mothers and fathers, or just one cousin or grandmother or somebody, going to school, not getting the nutrition they need in terms of intellectual ideas, books, and encouragement to be, you know, what they can become. And this is an issue that I'm concerned about now, the next generation, what's happening to them. And that is really a product of my own experience growing up, you know, in the Bronx. But I soon left the Bronx, and not only physically to explore Manhattan, to explore the rest of the city, but also to engage with the great issues of our times, my time, which was the civil rights movement. You know, James Baldwin, the great black writer, went to be with Clinton, and as did County Cullen, the poet, and many others. And I became involved in the civil rights movement in the Bronx, where we boycotted and picketed the Woolworth store, which was a company that was practicing segregated lunch counters in the South, and was the center of the student activism that helped bring down segregation, the sit-ins at the lunch counters at Woolworths. One of the kids that actually was at North Carolina A&T, a black college in Greensboro, North Carolina, the first sit-ins, came from Clinton, and he was one of the four students that sat down on February 1st, 1960, and helped change America. And this is the movement that gave us Martin Luther King and gave us so many great leaders and so much pain and so many people who died. I was privileged at Cornell to meet Malcolm X and to invite him to speak at Cornell and spend time with him. Of course, he became a victim of an assassin's bullet, and a full investigation has not happened to this day about who really killed Malcolm X and what was behind his murder. Probably the same about Martin Luther King. There are still lots of questions about what happened to him, and Bobby Kennedy as well, and President Kennedy for that matter. So we live in a violent culture, a violent society, and a society that imposes violence in the rest of the world. That's what these drones are all about. That's what this a projection of American power is all about. I grew up during the days of the Vietnam War, and we opposed the war. And you know, the war became, in a sense, inhabited our minds and our brains. We thought about it all the time. We protested against it all the time, for years, not just for hours, not just for days. And then, you know, in the 70s, when I worked at WBCN, I actually got to go to Vietnam, which was amazing. And I went to North Vietnam, to Hanoi, and I went to South Vietnam, what was then Saigon, now Ho Chi Minh City. And visited Cambodia, visited Laos, saw what was happening to a whole part of our planet that was destroyed by Agent Orange, by chemical weapons, by all sorts of attacks. And all of this sensitized me, raised my consciousness, raised my awareness, made me want to fight back against this society and this system. At the same time, I had to think about what could I do to make a living, you know, and what could I do about the future. I ended up going to the London School of Economics by, you know, believe it or not, the London School of Economics might cost $200 a year, then it was a lot cheaper than any American university. So I went there and I met people from all over the world who were at that university, some of whom I'm still connected with, still friendly with to this day. And so all of these experiences helped shape my mind and my values and what I did and what I cared about, having been in the civil rights movement as an activist, as a full-time organizer in Harlem, in Baltimore, and in other places. You know, I brought that background with me to the London School of Economics, and where, you know, it was a different type of culture. It was more class-based than race-based in terms of what people cared about. But there were, at the London School of Economics, students who had fled South Africa, who were there because the apartheid system had forced them out of their own country. They were in exile, and there were many great exile leaders who were part of the African National Congress, the ANC. And the ANC, of course, today is the government of South Africa. But then it was considered a terrorist movement. The people from the United States, people from the South African African National Congress were not allowed in the United States because they were allied with the Communist Party of South Africa. We had these Cold War, you know, fears and you know, ideologies then. And so the ANC couldn't even be part of the United States. But because I was in London, I met people from the ANC. And in the course of all of this, you know, this was a time of not only, the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and all of the cultural revolution taking place in England, but a revolution around the world, a revolution that, you know, erupted in Europe, in France, and all over the world. And I went to Germany. I marched in the streets of Berlin. I went to Paris, and I was part of the May-June uprising there. I worked for an American magazine called Ramparts, which was an investigative magazine. And we began investigating the role of the CIA, the role it was playing in infiltrating into our student movements. And this was part of my education. But, you know, and back in London, I later got files from the CIA showing that they were spying on me, your news dissector. Oh, no. You know, and there's this one document, which I just love, you know, done by a CIA person. I think I know who she is, a very beautiful French woman who I met, apparently, because this document seems to have been written by a French person. And so here I thought, well, finally, here's a document that's going to show what a right-on revolutionary I am, what a threat to the state, what a threat to the imperial order, you know, et cetera and so forth. It showed, and basically, her view of me was like a teddy bear, you know. She was, she said I wore my hair in a bouffant style, more common among women, you know. You know, it was a humiliating CIA document, you know, kind of showing me to be, a nice person, a good person, where I saw myself as this militant activist. So in a sense, that was, interesting observation by someone from the working for the CIA or reporting for the CIA. Anyway, you know, so, and this was a period of covert action. You remember Che Guevara was underground in Bolivia, later assassinated as there was an effort made to spread the revolution worldwide. And, you know, he represented that value of international solidarity, that we not only cared about what was happening to us in America, but we were in solidarity with, we cared about what's happening to people in other countries. That to us was very important. That was a principle. We cared about the Vietnamese people. And so we didn't just oppose the war. We supported their efforts to win back their country. And of course, in South Africa, we didn't just say apartheid is bad. We said the ANC is right, that the liberation movements deserved to be supported and helped. So it was one thing to say that, you know, kind of easy to say it, I guess, if you're not there. But in my case, I got challenged. And this is what's interesting. A South African guy said, listen, you know, I hear that you're very active in criticizing apartheid. What are you willing to do about it? And I said, what do you mean? What can I do? I'm here in London. You know, I've gone to a rally. I've gone to a demonstration. I'm, supporting what's going on. And I said, no. That's easy, isn't it? What risks are you willing to take for this revolution in South Africa? And I said, risks? What do you mean, risks? I mean, I'm speaking out. What else can I do? And they said, well, we actually have something for you to do. And I said, well, who's we? They said, well, it's the ANC underground movement. Would you be willing to go into South Africa, okay, as an American, because Americans can get in, our people can't get in, and do a mission for us in South Africa? And I said, well, you know, I have to check my schedule. I didn't say that. I said, well, yeah, I'd love to be helpful. What's involved? And they said, well, look, if you're interested, we're going to tell you about it, but you can't tell anybody else. Plus, you know, in a sense, you know, we'll kill you. But they didn't say that. You know, I just felt, you know, this was something I agreed to. I was, you know, talking about it would be hypocritical not to do something if I could do it. And so, lo and behold, I got involved as in the South African Revolution. Now, I wasn't, you know, dropping, you know, regular bombs or doing anything violent. I wasn't a believer in that. I believed in nonviolence because of our movement in America, the civil rights movement. Now the Occupy movement believes in nonviolence. But I also believed in direct action. You've got to put your life on the line for what you believe in. And so here I was, and this is, I've really never written about this until now. There's a new book out called London Recruits, The Secret War Against Apartheid. And it's about how students in England were recruited by the ANC and sent into South Africa on underground missions. In one case, one was arrested and was imprisoned. It was a scary time. And this new book is introduced by the former intelligence minister of South Africa, Ronnie Kasrils, a foreword by Paulo Jordan, one of the great leaders and thinkers of the ANC in South Africa. And so I was asked to write about this. Now, up until now, I've talked about how I went there, but always implying somehow I was a journalist. I was just wanting to see it for myself as a student. But actually, I went there with believe it or not, a suitcase with a, you know, false bottom, and in it were leaflets, you know, calling for revolution and change in South Africa. And we created these leaflet bombs that we released in public to show the public in South Africa that the ANC was still there, because this was the time when Nelson Mandela had been sentenced to life in prison, and the leaders of the ANC were sentenced to life in prison. The ANC was being crushed by the apartheid regime. It was being really, people were being murdered in their beds. It was a very desperate time, dark days in South Africa. And so, you know, I said, well, okay, what do I have to do? And so they taught me how to make this poster bomb, which was using, believe it or not, with an old parking meter mechanism, you know, with tick, 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 and you would add a razor blade, you know, to the end of it, to a package of leaflets. After a certain amount of time, the razor blade would cut through the string, and the leaflets would be released into the public. So you had to find a place to release them from. And so I've now written an essay in this book, London Recruits, The Secret War Against Apartheid. And I'll be going to South Africa and meeting some of the other London recruits who are going to be there speaking about what they did. And my essay, and I'll just read you a little of it, I think you might find it interesting, that called The Day I Joined the Revolution. I was 25 years old. I was righteous, identified with the need for a revolution in my own country and around the world. I had not yet completed my lifelong journey from activist to journalist. I was political. I was passionate. I was part of a generation that wanted change and was determined to be part of a struggle to achieve it. We were living in the 1960s in revolutionary times in swinging London. And of course, we were shaped by its fashions, its hopes, even some of its illusions. We loved the Beatles. We fancied ourselves street-fighting men, a la the Rolling Stones. We wanted to be Che Guevara's, who was killed in 1967. We were engaged and we were ready to rock. We wanted the war in Vietnam to end and the apartheid system to end with it. I'm reading now from my essay in this book, London Recruits. Many of us were available to serve our values and join the fight for justice, but few were chosen. My opportunity to join a real revolution soon came in the form of a furtive and hushed invitation from a charismatic friend in the African National Congress to secretly slip into apartheid South Africa to, quote, help. It was also a concrete challenge to someone who talked about revolution to put up or shut up. A concrete chance to put my own life on the line for a cause I believed in and to support a movement I admired. It was hard to say no, even though, as I write here, I was scared shitless. There I say it, scared shitless. Before I came to the London School of Economics, I started running with South Africans. I had been deeply immersed in the struggle for civil rights. So this is an excerpt from this essay in London Recruits. It's published by Merlin Books, and it's going to be available on Amazon very shortly, merlinpress.co.uk. It's a book about the recollections, the remembrances of the people who were part of this movement. And, I think you'll find it interesting because it's an effort to recount a part of my own history. And I guess I never want to talk about it because I was afraid, like, you could be called a terrorist if you, did. But, the ANC is now basically well accepted. I was at this event this past week with Bill Clinton praising Nelson Mandela. At the time, Nelson Mandela's picture could not be shown in South Africa. He could not be quoted because of the anti-terrorism laws of apartheid South Africa. So I became involved in that movement. I went to South Africa, and in a way, I didn't leave for 30 years because I still am involved in South Africa since the 60s. I've made all these films. I did the series South Africa Now on PBS, public PBS stations. PBS never supported it, but public television stations like Channel 13 in New York did show it every week. I also helped organize the Sun City album with 54 artists, including Bruce Springsteen, Bono, Little Steven, Van Zandt, Peter Gabriel, Miles Davis, and many others who called for sanctions against South Africa, starting in the music industry, which they were part of. Don't play Sun City was the refrain of that particular song. So I've been active and involved in this for a long time, in the media, outside the media, and now, as I disclose in this new book, London Recruits, The Secret War Against Apartheid, as an activist actually on an underground mission in South Africa. I'm saying this not to boast, not to promote myself, but really to basically call on others to take action on things you believe in, to get involved. Because when you do, your whole life changes. You begin to see the world in a very different way. You begin to meet people you never thought you'd meet. Who thought, when I was in South Africa in 1967, I just found my passport from those days, today, with a picture looking very straight, suit and tie and all the rest of it, my passport picture. Who thought then, I never did, that I would be there in 1994 when Nelson Mandela was elected president of South Africa, when this whole system began to change? Has it changed enough? No. In fact, my book, Blogathon, Reflections and Revelations from the News Dissector, that's just come out, has a series of essays about South Africa today that I wrote last summer. And I, talk about a lot of the negative things I found there, including massive corruption, which is very disappointing and very distressing. And I felt like I had to talk about it and want to hush it up or cover it up. So this is an ongoing struggle. Nothing changes forever, permanently. But certainly democracy is certainly better than apartheid in South Africa. The people of South Africa of all races are able to vote now, which they never could do before. They have a constitution giving them rights that we don't have in our own constitution here in America. In other words, we can learn from share the experiences of other countries. And this is why I think it's really important to get tuned into the global culture and learn by from others and about other cultures and realize that if you care about changing America, you have to care about changing the world. I'll be back in a minute with more from my book, some reflections from Kat Waters, who's in the studio now, and I'm giving her, you know, a moment to speak, but I hope I haven't put you to sleep. And please stay with us here on PRN.
We're going to fix that technical problem.
ABC.
NBC.
CBS.
CNN.
Fox News. Breaking news.
Faking news. The media war. It's time to get sore.
This is some kind of bizarre reality TV show.
I worked at ABC News, worked at CNN. To see so many colleagues, if you will, acting as a megaphone for the military and for the administration.
General. Thank you, sir. Thank you, sir.
The Pentagon also controls the timing of bad news, the heavy-handed way of managing the message.
Media.
Managing the message.
All the networks wanted to have was a countdown to war.
Overemphasis. Overkill.
48 hours to war.
You are listening to PRN.FM, the Progressive Radio Network.
Honesty without fear. The Whistleblowers Radio Hour on Tuesdays at 1 p.m.
After every scandal, we learned that there were citizens who tried to alert the public, but were silenced and retaliated against.
I did not grow up wanting to become a whistleblower, but it was my job and my moral obligation to demand that truth and justice be honored.
Hear from leading whistleblower lawyers about how you can protect yourself if you expose waste, fraud, or corruption.
This country would be a much better place when we all recognize the contributions that whistleblowers make to our society and protect them from retaliation.
Learn from prominent whistleblowers who've lived through it.
Support those who protect you.
Whistleblowers are key to holding government and corporations accountable. Empower yourself. Know your rights.
Tune in to hear me interview some of our nation's heroes.
Tune in to Honesty Without Fear, Tuesdays at 1 p.m. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Hi, I'm Karen Hartglass, the host of It's All About Food. Join me every Wednesday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, where we talk about my favorite subject, food. Learn how you can make a positive difference in your life and all life on Earth every time you eat. To listen to the show, go to PRN.FM. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you are coming with us.
Oh, Jeff.
Yes, Lee?
I just want you to know.
What?
You occupy my heart.
Aww.
Cheater on the Rude with Jeff Chrysler
and Lee Papa.
Thursdays, 8 p.m. Eastern.
Check out our old shows on the archives.
Archives? That sounds like some weird yellow moldy paper stuff.
And you can listen to all of our old moldy shows at PRN.FM.
Did you hear the Progressive Radio Network has a new slogan?
It does.
It does. Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you are coming with us.
That sounds sort of progressive.
It does, it does, but I think it needs to be a little more demanding.
Progressive Radio Network is moving forward,
and we want you to come
with us.
Hi, I'm Dr. Len Saputo.
And I'm registered nurse Vicki Saputo. Join us on our weekly Prescriptions for Health call-in talk show on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com every Monday live from 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time and from 12 noon to 1 p.m. Pacific Time.
We'll be talking about current health news, plus Vicki shares her entertaining 2020 health tips at 20 after and 20 to the hour.
And if you miss our live Monday shows, they're archived on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com and Dr. Saputo. That's DocTorSaputo.com.
The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you are coming with us.
This is PRN.FM. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Masters of war, you that build of gods, that built the death plane, you that built all the bombs, you that hide behind walls, you that hide behind desks. I just want you to know I can see through your mask. You that never done nothing.
Beautiful.
But built to destroy. You play with my world like it's your little toy. You put a gun in his hand and you hide from his eyes. And you turn and run farther when the fast bullets fly.
Well, that, of course, is that beautiful, powerful song written by Bob Dylan, questioning the masters of war, challenging the masters of war. You know, 2 weeks ago or so, one of the masters of war, our own president, Barack Obama, honored Bob Dylan in the White House with a Medal of Freedom. And, of course, talked about Bob Dylan's influence on him. You know, if Bob Dylan had the guts, he should have gotten up there and sung Masters of War, because we're in the same situation in some respects that we've been in for so many years, with presidents arrogating to themselves the power to kill, the power to make war on other countries. We're at war now on Iran, basically thanks to these secret, covert, viruses that are being spread in Iran by the United States, working with Israel. This is an act of war. And the fact that, you know, here's our president honoring the great rebel poet Bob Dylan in the White House. Good. That's great. Better him than certainly some others I can think of. At the same time, the contradiction just screams at me, just disappoints me, just upsets me. I did a profile of Bob on 2020 years ago and got to talk with him and meet him and work with him on the Sun City album. And, you know, somebody I admire and respect. And yes, he deserves the recognition. He deserves to be honored for his great contribution to our culture and our country. But this gap between what he cares about and his symbolic role needs to be discussed. I just want to note, Catherine Waters came back from the Bilderberg Conference in Chantilly, Virginia, and she drove back with a woman named Tatiana Moros. And Tatiana gave her an album that she's done, a musical album called Love and Liberty. And I just picked it up now, and I just saw it, and I saw that she sings Masters of War. She also does A Heart of Gold, Neil Young's great song that I love so much as well. You just heard her powerful voice. This is a real talent. You know, we're going to hear a lot more from Tatiana, I believe, in the future. What was she like?
Oh, very, very outspoken. I had just met her there through my friend Dan Panzella, who drove. And, it was very interesting. I actually had, the recording microphone device from the radio station Progressive Radio Network, and I recorded some of, the conversation. I mean, imagine driving, 6 hours, from Virginia back to, New Jersey and New York with, six, outspoken, people in the car. I mean, it was crazy. It was very heated,
That rhetoric could have moved the car. You didn't even need gasoline. You had so many people there. Anyway, Tatiana is the singer. You've just heard from her. I'm Danny Schechter, your News Dissector, continuing with this special edition of News Dissector Radio here on Progressive Radio Network, PRN FM. Our program is heard every week on Fridays from 1 to 2. I am now in South Africa working on a film about Nelson Mandela alongside the making of this new major motion picture, Long Walk to Freedom, which is his autobiography being made by a film company in South Africa led by Anant Singh, who's a filmmaker who's done a lot of work about telling the South African story through the eyes and hopes of South Africans. And this film is finally being made. Nelson Mandela authorized it. Mandela himself has now left Johannesburg, moved back to Kunu in the Transkei, which is where he grew up as in a royal family, as an indigenous person in South Africa. He went from this a very poor, small village into becoming one of the leaders that the world respects the most. Mandela's on the top of everybody's list. He is now at age, he turns 94 in July. He's been on this long walk to freedom for so long, and he's now getting the right for a long rest, in Kunu. I doubt I'll see him when I go to South Africa. I've made many films about him. But I'm honored to be here. There I'm writing. I'm talking a few days before I leave for South Africa, and I'm really thrilled to be part of this effort, not just to tell Mandela's story as a great man, but to remind us that there was a movement that he led. It wasn't just one person. It wasn't just a celebrity. You know, he was the leader of a movement of millions of people, and he was a person that was a lawyer. He tried through the law, through the courts, to represent the needs and interests of oppressed people in South Africa, and came to the conclusion that because of the apartheid laws, that wasn't possible. And so he became active in an underground movement, Mkhonto Isizwe it was called, which was the armed wing of the African National Congress. He became a general. He traveled surreptitiously to other parts of Africa, to Algeria, to Morocco, to meet and learn from revolutionaries about the military skills that he didn't have. And he came back to South Africa and was arrested. And many Americans don't know this, but Nelson Mandela was arrested with a tip from the CIA to the white South African government. So the CIA was very involved in his arrest, and he was later sentenced, to life in prison. And it was on Robben Island, in this hellhole of a prison that I later got to visit, where Mandela and his comrades stayed for all those years, in the cold of an island off the coast of Cape Town in South Africa. And Mandela survived imprisonment, survived the threat of execution, only to actually negotiate the release of many prisoners, to finally negotiate with the apartheid regime to set a date for an election, and to win that election on the 27th of April, 1994. I was there. I filmed it for a film called Countdown to Freedom. It was one of the great moments, if you will, of my own life, to be in his company and to be exposed to this great victory for people. Now, since then, we had a constitutional victory in South Africa, but we didn't have a social revolution there. The social revolution is still happening, if you will. There's still a tremendous gap between the rich and the poor in South Africa, a tremendous amount of corruption, a tremendous amount of ways in which small elite, mostly of whites, but also now of some blacks, are enjoying, a very wealthy lifestyle, while most of the people are not. We have to acknowledge these issues and these problems, and Mandela has to be, in a way, looked at as a transitional leader. He was one of the first and only African leaders to step down after one term. Others wanted to be president for life. He stepped down, supported democracy, and people who worked with him, often criticized him. I mean, he was not like, giving orders to everyone. He was part of what he called, at the time, a collective leadership, where others had their say. Yes, Catherine?
Well, he was actually walking the walk. I mean, he was, living and demonstrating what he believed and trying to be, democratic and not all about himself.
That is very true, you know, at the same time. You know, when you become the president of a country, when you become a global hero, a hero for all, when you're in the media, you know, other leaders, other presidents, other people, you know, want to be your friend. They want to, you know, kind of co-opt you in different ways. And, you know, Mandela, you know, was seduced by many of these people in many ways. But he was also up against international capital, the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, who wanted to put a brake on the South African Revolution, who wanted South Africa, the new South Africa, the South Africa that was elected by the people, to pay the debt of the South Africa that was dominated by a handful of whites, the Afrikaner-led South Africa, apartheid South Africa, and the world forced the new South Africa to pay the debts of the old South Africa. And those debts, a lot of them were actually payments that the white South African government made for arms that they used against the majority, against black people. So this is part of the ironies of what a struggle is really about. And by being there, by being honored to be, you know, in the presence of people like this, I learned a tremendous amount about the struggle. His most recent book, Mandela's most recent book, is called Conversations with Myself. And in it, he paints a picture of himself as a flawed person, as a person who, you know, sort of was a ladies' man and then became a family man. He was, you know, a lawyer and then became a guerrilla. You know, he became he reinvented himself constantly, and he's very critical, self-critical, critical of himself for mistakes that he made and issues, you know, in his treatment of his wives or his, many of his children felt, you know, Tata, they called him, you know, you're the father of our nation, but you're not a father of our family. We never see you. You're always traveling. You're always, you know, in meetings and the like. So there are contradictions in his life story that are important to understand, not to judge and condemn him, but to at least acknowledge, you know, this reality and to praise the fact that he's willing to talk about all this stuff. He's not just on an ego trip. He's not just saying, look, I'm great. You did all these things. He never talks about I. He talks about we. He talks about his movement. And the people who were in prison with him saw him as their leader, but they also were his leader. They were the people he listened to. And this is why a movement can be democratic. It can be from the bottom up. It can make a difference. And I believe that Mandela's story, when understood, is really a story of a lot of people in South Africa. His divorce, you know, with Winnie Mandela that made, you know, a lot of news. You know, so many South African families were broken apart by apartheid.
Mandela sounds very humble, and it sounds like that's what separates him from a lot of leaders who are not self-reflective, who are not able to look at themselves, to be self-critical, to, you know, admit, you know, that, you know, they're flawed. I mean, that's what keeps people in check, unlike, yeah, you know, the people that are running Wall Street.
Absolutely.
And, you know,
he used his power, what power he had, his moral power, if you will, to push on other leaders to do more. Bill Clinton, I was just at this dinner with Bill Clinton. He was speaking about the AIDS issue, that Mandela, you know, said, Bill, I need your help to lower the price of AIDS medicines. AIDS medicines made in America cost 10 times as much as AIDS medicines made in India and in other countries.
Why is that?
Because of profit motive and greed and all the rest of it.
Right.
And Bill Clinton got involved, and he talked about how they did it, you know, how they built a partnership, how they tried to get, you know, the pharmaceutical companies to recognize that if they cut their prices, they would also have more customers. So they wouldn't necessarily lose money if they made it available more inexpensively. And in that respect, I think, you know, Bill Clinton's was motivated by Nelson Mandela to do all this. And, you know, tens of thousands of people's lives have been saved because of the availability of AIDS drugs now. When, you know, having AIDS before was a death sentence, you know. There was no chance of surviving. Now, you know, not just their efforts. Let's not, you know, forget the movements that fought against, you know, AIDS, the people who marched against AIDS, the Men's Health Crisis Center, all of the movements that have made this issue theirs. But there is a role here in which leaders were pushed to do more than they had been doing.
Now all we have to do is get Bill Clinton to help, you know, the greedy capitalists to realize that you actually benefit more when you, you know, lower the price and actually make things attainable for the rest of the people alive on this planet.
I was just talking before about the Medal of Freedom ceremony and about Barack Obama giving the Medal of Freedom to Toni Morrison and Bob Dylan and all these other great people, while at the same time a lot of what he does is really contrary to the values that they represent. Back in 2000, I was actually trying to make a film about a great American economist named John Kenneth Galbraith. Galbraith was a giant physically, over 7 feet tall. He was a Harvard professor. He was an author of, you know, many, many books. He was a historian of the Great Depression, which, you know, he basically explained as an example of fraud, basically, on Wall Street, crime that took place that helped bring down the stock market. John Kenneth Galbraith, if you don't know his work, check it out. Anyway, Galbraith was being given the Medal of Freedom by Bill Clinton. And I was trying to make a film about him. And, of course, at that time, I went to PBS, the American Masters series, try to see if they were interested. They weren't, of course. You know, who? John who? You know, they were, like, oblivious to economic issues. And Galbraith really warned us about this coming depression that we're in right now. So Clinton honored Galbraith, you know, at this Medal of Freedom thing. And I was there in the White House. Jesse Jackson was also honored, and others. Elie Wiesel was honored. You know, it was quite a group of people that he honored. But, you know, he honored Galbraith, but he didn't listen to Galbraith. He didn't learn from Galbraith. That's why he was one of the people, essentially, that went along with the ending of the Glass-Steagall Act, which was the regulatory framework that might have prevented this financial crisis by not allowing banks, to make all these investments and in all these various products, special, derivatives that have helped bring down the world economy. So, and Clinton admitted later in an interview, he said, this was the biggest mistake I made in office, was to allow the abolition of the Glass-Steagall Act. And why was it abolished? In the name of, quote, modernization. Let's modernize our regulatory framework, you know. And that's a code word, in a way, for let's give the bankers what they want. We just earlier we had a guest on our show called Leo Haviland, the author of a book called Words on the Street, Language and the American Dream on Wall Street. And, you know, he talked about how language is used to deceive people. In this case, they were deceiving people about the need for this regulatory reform, which was actually a giveaway to the financial industry. And if you go to my book, Blogathon, Reflections and Revelations from the News Dissector, just out from Cosimo Books. I write a lot about Wall Street and about what Wall Street represents, and particularly about the role of financial fraud and the reality of corruption in America. The F word for fraud is back in polite conversation on Wall Street. Fraud and financial crime are slowly becoming part of the debate over what must be done to restore confidence in what so plainly has been a confidence game. Drilling for oil has knocked financial reform out of the headlines, I wrote back in April 2010. But among commentators, a concern with crime and the absence of punishment is being raised again. And so I write about all this. And in this book, I also quote from a defiant message that was, quote, pinging around the trading desks on Wall Street. Listen to this. It says, "We are Wall Street. It's our job to make money. Whether it's a commodity, stock, bond, or some hypothetical piece of fake paper, it doesn't matter. We would trade baseball cards if it were profitable. go ahead and continue to take us down, but you're only going to hurt yourselves. What's going to happen when we can't find jobs on the street anymore? Guess what? We're going to take yours. We aren't dinosaurs. We are smarter and more vicious than that, and we're going to survive. This is a proclamation of defiance from Wall Street. You can read about this in the essays I've written about financial crime in the book Blogathon. It's available on Amazon. It's available at CosimoBooks.com. It's my 14th book. It features some of my blogs. I've also just come out with a new edition of Occupy, Dissecting Occupy Wall Street, also from Cosimo Books, and Plunder, the Crime of Our Time is my film. The Crime of Our Time is my book on financial fraud. So I'm trying to inform people about this. It's an uphill battle because a lot of people don't want the details. You know, don't tell me all these details. When I worked for 2020 at ABC News, I was constantly warned about what they called the MIGO effect. MIGO stands for my eyes glaze over. Don't give people too much information because their eyes will glaze over and they won't watch television. Keep it stupid. Keep it simple. Dumb it down. That's the mantra of much of our media, and I have been challenging that, which is probably why I'm on the Progressive Radio Network, not on the on the CBS network.
It sounds like the public has the MIGO, my eyes glaze over effect from being dumbed down. Well, has created the MIGO effect.
Well, that's true. And this is the
America, from not being challenged enough.
This is the America that we live in. This is the America we need to change. Trying to educate and inform people is what I try to do. I'm doing it with a blog at newsdissector.net. I'm doing it with this radio program every week on Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM. I've written 14 books, as I mentioned. And I'm also, you know, trying, if you will, to get you involved, you, whoever is listening to this, if you are interested in getting involved, if you want to help in some way, please write to me at dissector@mediachannel.org, dissector@mediachannel.org, and .org, and volunteer. Tell us what you can do. I'm going to be away for a few weeks now in South Africa making this new film. I've just finished a TV series called Who Rules America, which I hope to be, will get on the air, and I hope that you will be able to see at some point. So I'm busy doing all of this work, media work, but I'm going to keep on doing it. How much time do we have now, Maestro? We have 6 minutes to go, so we're going to keep on keeping on. As they say, it's hard to know because we didn't have the proper break on the program, but I really want your involvement. This is a participatory thing. This is not just a Danny Schechter thing or a Gary Null thing or a host thing. If this is going to have any impact whatsoever, people have to get involved, not just passively as listeners, as Facebook friends, as email, you know, advocates, but as directly involved in politics and political action and activism. That's what I've been doing a good part of my life. I can't claim that we've had tremendous success, although if you look at the, you know, the achievements of the civil rights movement, if you look at the achievements of the movements in South Africa, if you look at the fact that the war in Vietnam actually ended as a result in part because of activism, you know that people can make a difference. But will people make a difference? Will you, if you're listening, make a difference? Will you be willing to stand up and say, yes, count me in. I want to be involved to some degree in this fight for justice, in this fight for change in America. Final thought, Catherine, keep it short because we're out of time.
Well, I just wanted to let everyone know this is going to be now June 7th, yesterday, but now this is airing on the 15th down at Zuccotti Park with Chris Hedges, Father Daniel Berrigan, who are taking on Trinity Church for the arrests of some of the activists back in December that were trying to occupy a vacant lot owned by Trinity Church. And the trial is going to be Monday, which is going to be over by the time, again, this...
All right, so let's not announce something that already happened, but forgive us, Father, forgive us our trespasses. Yes,
so,
Catherine.
So is Trinity Church a church or is it a real estate? You know, which is it?
It's both, it seems. at any rate, you know, that's the struggle that we're in right now. It's a fight against hypocrisy. It's a fight against duplicity. It's a fight against deception. It's a fight for freedom. It's a fight for change. You are welcome to be part of it, to join it, and to help us get the resources we need to bring this message to more people all over the world. I'm Danny Schechter. I'm your news dissector. I'm here today on this special program. And please listen. We're going to replay some of my favorite programs here on PRN FM. Going out with the song now, Plunder, which is written by Polarity One. It's about Bernie Madoff. It's about the fight against Wall Street. Check it out right now.
Your Honor, for many years, I operated a Ponzi scheme through the investment advisory side of my business. I knew what I was doing was wrong, indeed criminal.
The shine on America's shoes got gold. When Wall Street stepped into the fold, Congress paid off, workers laid off. Stanford, AIG, and Madoff. Credit swaps, credit stops, empty wallets and empty shops, and bank walking, AAA. Grandpa loses 401k.